This is the Manifest Destiny Podcast, number 36. Manifest Destiny is a novel I wrote in 1991. The subtitle is The Rough and Ready Balloon Invasion of the Lunar Peninsula of Texas. My name is Peter Gelman. If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please go back and start with episode 1. I will now read chapter 35. This is the last chapter. The Puppet Head. Captain Mansfield dragged the metal carcass of Prince President Franklin Stove on a little ways. When I was walking around in the night, afraid to sleep because I was afraid I wouldn't wake up, I saw the automaton propped up against the flagpole. He stood high on the rampart there for a long time, I understand, until stolen by someone who wanted to sell him to P.T. Barnum. The flag flew at half-mast. The infirmary was all out of Rupert's tonic. Not all of the fresh supplies had been distributed yet. Kelly yelled at Dr. Payne until he wrote Kelly a letter authorizing him to find me some. I smelled the chicken soup that Sarah was serving all the officers of the 7th, and I heard them toast her as Sarah Bordet, the Angel of Fort Brown. So long, Cactus Queen. All of the tents of the 7th Infantry, including the infirmary, were pitched just outside the wall of the fort. I was looking at my swollen-up hand, feeling dizzy, feverish, thinking about that fourth error in the slow poke score. I heard Half-Lip McCoy leading my pals with this song. Frankie in the Moon. Franklin Stove was a fine old chap until he fell in a foul scrap. 'Cause he had a wooden head, he didn't know that he were dead. Neither did the cock and hens, who used his skull for a fox fence. But like an egg cracked by a spoon, now we guess his soul in ruin. Like us, the prince is just wheels and strings. We loved him so, but we don't like kings. He's busted now, ain't much to sell. He's just a scarecrow sentinel. That song made Captain Mansfield a bit angry. We are more than chips and strings, more than wheels and brute reactions. We're more. I wasn't so much angry as worried that that's all I was. My chips were all unstrung, and my strings had cashed their chips. Wallace Gordon was showing some crawdads how to cook Rattler. He picked Bradley Abernathy to mind the fork. It was an elaborate process. First he cut the head off, ka-chunk. Then he threw the snaky carcass on a hot griddle, just like that. The frying snake hissed and sizzled. A cooking smell filled the air. It was more or less a familiar smell, like broiling chicken. But like that chicken had fed on a caoutchouc rubber all its life. I thought maybe the rattler's flesh had some natural antidotal properties, so I sat down with them and waited. Bradley Abernathy said I was getting some kind of pale and mottled. "Well, I guess this is so long, then," I said, and shook hands all around. "First whooped, then snake bit," said Kidney Beanton admiringly. "Don't forget heartbroken," I added. I laid down and put the back of my hand over my burning eyes. "If I miss mess call, don't bother to drum up the reverend," I told them. I knew they thought I was a goner when they gave me 3 hurrahs. "Where is Kelly with that Rupert's?" I wondered impatiently. I heard a rattling sound close. I sat up quick. Abernathy said, "Mr. Gordon, it's moving." Laughed Wallace, his back to Abernathy. "Mr. Gordon, they're moving! Mr. Gordon!" The headless snake was sidewinding on the hot iron. "Yes, when its spine gets hot enough, it gets kind of a second life. Personally, I don't care for it that raw. Mind you keep them on the pan, boy." Suddenly, one of the coiled-up headless snakes lunged forward like it was striking. Abernathy dropped the fork and ran about 40 yards off. From that distance, he turned back and looked. "Lost your appetite for fresh rattler? What a greenhorn," scoffed Wallace. Seeing that headless snake move was giving me poison chills, I walked away and laid down again. I woke up late with Kelly shaking me. "Jack, Jack, Jack, wake up." "No," I groaned. I felt hot and dizzy, and there was a pain in my chest and in my eyes. I couldn't feel my bit up hand. It was so swollen, I couldn't move the fingers. I turned my face away from it. Behind Kelly was an old Lunarita. She was very old and dressed in black. She wore layers and layers of shawls, veils, serapes, and dresses. I wondered if she was like one of them hollow dolls that you keep opening up to find a smaller one inside to open again. She was searching among the dead for her grandson, or maybe great-grandson, I reckon, said Kelly. "She don't seem to speak much our language, but she seems to listen to it all right. I am paying her to cure you. You know, those Injuns have ancient tricks, like snake bit cures from beetle dung and grubs and the like." "Kelly, I don't care much for beetle dung and grubs." "I told her to give you whatever it takes to cure you, brother. Now just rest easy now." It hurt to open my eyes, so I closed them. I felt her warm, rough hands on my forehead. She put something bitter in my mouth. It tasted like ashes. I thought she was poisoning me. She pinched my nose until I opened my mouth, and I swallowed some more. I hated the taste of it. My dizziness concentrated. I felt like I was falling and falling. That vertigo landed me in the land of Nod. I fell in a deep sleep. And then I had a strange dream. I dreamed that I was thirsty as all heck. Probably I was, which is the fault of the fever. So I got up. I was in a tent with 3 wool blankets on me. My brother sat in a stool beside me, slumped over, asleep. His Walter Scott lay open on the ground. Looked like the last week's events had taken the entertainment out of it for Kelly. So I got up and I looked for water. Not finding any, I went outside. It was dark. I still couldn't find any buckets. Then I heard the cold sea, so I headed that way. I kneeled at the shore and drank the Mare Frigoris, being a freshwater sea. It was delicious. I felt a lot better. The swelling of my hand had gone down. I unwrapped the bandage a little. There were just two very tiny dots. I stretched my back, still sore, but not raw. All in all, I was fit as a fiddle again. Put me in an omnipotent point of view. Looking up, I saw in the distance Martha Mule. I walked over to her. She ate up one of my stale army crackers. I got up on her and rode along the shore a ways, thinking about how close the far shore looked. I wondered what was going on in Plato's crater. Probably a lot of panic. I wondered if Hernani Klager was over there somewhere, and I wondered what had happened to John Sheehan and the other deserters. Even in dream, it didn't please me that this was just the beginning of the war. The observation balloons had scared away the army of the Sea of Tranquility. Texas was Texas again. I had enough of fighting. I didn't want to cross the cold sea with Rough and Ready. Seemed to me the Lunars took punishment enough. Over 1,000 maimed and killed, if the moral surgeon's score was right. And I reckoned it was. Seemed to me that we didn't have call to invade Venus. We had Oregon. Even if a democratically elected president ordered me to go, didn't seem fair that I would have to. Made me feel like rotten corruption inside. Made me feel like one of Sergeant Mallory's chief disciples. Made me feel like a Hessian for the Democratic Party. I shouldn't ought to have signed up in the first place. Seemed to me that this was my best chance to desert, if I was a-going to do it. Of course, I didn't want to do that, if it meant I could never see Kelly again, or go back to Maryland. I didn't want to do it. But maybe I should, seeing as I shouldn't ought to and didn't truly deserve to be alive, let alone killing more folks. And after all, I knew this was just a friendly dream. Farther on in the mist, I saw another mule drinking water. I gave Martha a little tap with my heels. We headed that way. It was just a pale blur in the dark. It wasn't a mule. It was a horse. A white horse. A stallion feeding on some shore grass. As I got closer, I recognized it with a chill. I saw the corpse it dragged along, one foot still in the stirrup. Martha carried me over slowly. We came close, and there waited a nightmare. The white horse stood at the edge of the shore, hooves in the water, chewing a big clump of grass around a little tree stump. He lifted his head, still chewing, and carried up the stump, caught in the leaves and grass. As he chewed, the wooden hunk slipped down a little and swung, bobbing. It came closer, and the wild-eyed horse swung the head over, swinging the stump around at me. It bumped up and down with the rhythm of her chewing jaws. It was the long, missing head of Sergeant Weigart. It was blackish green and grinning. Its ugly jaws swung up and down in hideous humor, mocking the vanity of my intentions. The mule screamed and bucked wildly, knocking me into the water. The current was terribly swift. I spun round and round, fighting to stay alive. I shouted and kicked in the water. As I floated in my disorientation, I thought I saw the moon hovering green above me. It was just another pale blur in the dark. But even in my panic, I fancied I could see old Anaxagoras' crater. Flounder as I was, it struck me funny. If that was the moon up there, then where was I? Suddenly, I saw the shore up close and swam for it. I rose up on the wet bank and lay there until I caught my breath. I was grateful to claw the familiar yellow soil of the lunar POT. I was not grateful when someone kicked my foot. But I was not grateful when somebody kicked my foot. I started with annoyance, expecting to see Kelly. But when I looked behind me, I cried out and dragged myself away. There was a dead lunar soldier floating in the eddy. I looked all around. There were dozens of dead lunars drowned all around me. I stood up and saw all kinds of discarded equipment and signs that thousands of men had passed over this same bank. So the current had taken me down to where the lunars had fled in panic, back to their side of the cold sea. I rubbed my face and climbed the bank and headed along the shore to get away from the corpses. I was going to swim back to camp, but I hesitated getting back into the water. I felt lost. I hadn't got very far when I saw a dozen dragoons on patrol. They didn't look like lunars to me. As I came closer, I was surprised to see that these hussars were riding donkeys. I was just beginning to get over that surprise when I had another. I was delighted to see a familiar face. "Jack," laughed Hernani Klager. Next to him rode a big, red-headed officer I didn't recognize. Behind him was John Sheehan. Next to Sheehan rode Dick Parker and Patrick Maloney, those two deserters that Sam Walker had seen from his balloon. Following them were eight other doughboys who'd disappeared during the long march south from Annex Agonies. Deserters all, with swords. I saw Sarah's old husband, George Dalwig, riding among them. "Heck, George," I greeted him. "I didn't even know you'd skedaddled." He just shrugged and grinned bashfully. And then came about 100 lunar soldiers. I looked at the deserters and then back at the Lunars. Seemed like they were all sort of too friendly. "Is the war over, then?" I asked Hernani. Hernani laughed. I noticed he wasn't exactly dressed in regular blues. In fact, Hernani himself was wearing the darker blue, red-striped trousers of a Lunar Hussar. "There are 48 of us under Lieutenant John Wiley," he said, nodding his head at the big Irish beside him. "We are all volunteers in the Legion Extranjera." "You mean your strange legion is a bunch of no good traitors?" "Yes," he said with a blink. "We've been raining shells on you for the past couple of days." He swung off his donkey and picked me up. He tried to embrace me, but I wouldn't let him. "And so, here you are, like us. Not like a Napoleon, but like a doomed Hernani." "And so, here you are, like us. Not like a Napoleon, but like a doomed Hernani." "I don't mind saying that I don't like the sound of that." "I'm afraid, Jack, you have a choice of three vile fates. Will you be a prisoner, a deserter, or a traitor?" "A traitor?" "That's what they call it. But what are you now? You are neither a good man nor evil, but a war machine, working regardless of right and wrong. Have you no life, no moral sense? Must you be such a slave? All free men are traitors to something." "Hernani, I never guessed that my doom would have your face on it." Hernani put his arm around me and whispered, "Be careful, Jack. If you don't join us, one of the Lunar officers might break your arm." "Such a feeling I have, Jack. Such a terrible purity. Will you be such a wooden puppet of patriotism?" "Me? A wooden puppet?" I wondered. "Well, it's true. I used to be, more or less, a simpleton. But now there's too many wheels whirling inside my head. I can't even think a simple thought. I wish I were a machine. Then I wouldn't have this awful, mixed-up feeling." And then I thought, I guess I don't believe that I can honestly feel any pure feelings anymore. But I admit I'd like to believe that there is such a thing as right and wrong. This way I'm sure to find out. With any luck, I'll die before I have regrets. And as I rode behind Hernani on his donkey, I remember thinking, I hope one of these Lunars has a copy of Napoleon and his marshals. I found out I was wrong on every count. And so, do I find myself a universally scorned old gringo in the melancholy year 1878, in the town of Tasquillo, still intending to record, at the personal request of Mr. John F. Finnerty, foreign correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, time, pesos, and health willing, the incredibly tragicomic Lunar Adventures of one Hernani Klager, as told by Jack Borginis, the minor troublemaker, terrific trigonometrist of fate's trapeze, an uncommon balloon-born boll weevil, strangest stranger of the Legion of Strangers, prisoner patriot of the St. Patrick Battalion of the Moon, and party to the slaying of the Prince President, Franklin Stove, a metal man, and sometimes proud and sometimes happy husband of the celebrated two-fisted seamstress, Sarah Borginis, Bordette, Bowen, etc. Cactus Queen of the 7th Infantry, U.S. The end. You made it to the end of the story. I hope you liked it. A few notes. Reference to Mr. John F. Finnerty, foreign correspondent of the Chicago Tribune. I don't remember what my source was, but there was a reporter by that name, and he traveled in Mexico in 1878 and met an American deserter. This old soldier grew his hair long on one side of his face to cover up the letter D brand scarred into his face on one side. There was a Mexican battalion called St. Patrick's Battalion. I will now quote Wikipedia on St. Patrick's Battalion. The St. Patrick's Battalion, formed and led by John Riley, was a unit of 175 to several hundred immigrants, accounts vary, and expatriates of European descent who fought as part of the Mexican Army against the United States in the Mexican-American War of 1846 to 1848. Most of the battalion's members had deserted or defected from the U.S. Army, made up primarily of ethnic Irish and German Catholic immigrants. The battalion included Canadians, English, French, Italians, Poles, Scots, Spaniards, Swiss, native Mexicans, and disenfranchised Americans were in the ranks, including escaped slaves from the American South. The Mexican government offered incentives to foreigners who would enlist in its army, granting them citizenship, paying higher wages than the U.S. Army, and the offer of generous land grants. Only a few members of the St. Patrick's Battalion were actual U.S. citizens. Skipping ahead, for Americans of the generation that fought the Mexican-American War, the San Patricios were considered traitors. For Mexicans of that generation and generations to come, they were heroes who came to the aid of fellow Catholics in need. The Wikipedia notes that although more than 9,000 U.S. soldiers deserted the army during the Mexican-American War, only the captured San Patricios were punished by hanging. Those soldiers who had left military service before the official declaration of war on Mexico were sentenced to, quote, receive 50 lashes on their bare backs, to be branded with the letter D for deserter, and to wear iron yokes around their necks for the duration of the war. By order of General Winfield Scott, 30 San Patricios were to be executed at Chapultepec. That's the location of a castle, and there was a battle there. To be executed at Chapultepec in full view of the two armies who had fought there, at the precise moment that the flag of the USA replaced the flag of Mexico atop the citadel. The detail of the snakes, the behavior of the cooking headless rattlers. A friend of mine spent some time in cowboy country, Montana, and witnessed this behavior. And he described it to me in detail, giving me the chills. I hope you enjoyed this story. It has been a good and sometimes frustrating experience for me revisiting this story after all these years. When I started the podcast recording, I thought I would just do it quickly with no audio editing. But I became discontent with that, so at some point I changed my process, which slowed it down, took a lot more of my time. So if you have been able to hear it all and enjoy it, appreciate it, that pleases me. Thank you. If anybody remembers the old Fact Sheet 5 magazine, which reviewed zines in the mid-90s, one of its issues gave a nice review of Moonifest Destiny. I no longer have a copy. Now, here's a weird coincidence. In 2005, the animation The Simpsons ran an episode called See Homer Run. And surely you're familiar with Homer Simpson. In this episode, he wears a safety salamander costume, which includes a tail. And near the end of the episode, someone asks him how his tail moves. He says he doesn't know. And at the very end, it turns out there is a chicken in the tail. Now, I don't think that the writers listened to Moonifest Destiny, but I thought that was a curious semi-coincidence that the animation of Homer's tail is by a chicken. Okay, here is another little story about the history of this book. I don't remember when exactly, but I submitted a slightly shorter form of it to Galaxy magazine. The editor was Algis Budrys, and he wrote me back that it almost made publication, but as he thought about it, he found it, I think he used the term, the most fantastic failure that he had ever read. Now, that term we could interpret fantastic failure as an extreme failure, or as a work with a tragic contrast between its good points and its failings. I wasn't immediately sure how to take that comment, except that he asked me to submit something else as quick as possible for the next issue. I didn't have anything, so that was that. It is, to me, a fair criticism to call it a fantastic failure in the sense that I just described. Mr. Budrys also said that he thought the story was more interested in the superficial clicks and ticks of the Metal Man than other more important story elements. I don't think that's true, but I do think it has the burden of being overtly philosophical, as opposed to bringing the philosophy out indirectly, which probably, as a general rule, makes better storytelling. Maybe the advantage of being explicit is more detailed examination of such ideas. Also, the cosmology in the setting, to me, seems to set the storytelling on a vector with more explicit discussion of ideas, which to people who are not interested in that kind of discussion definitely hurts the storytelling. But still, I find it interesting. Unfortunately, the topic of war and freedom, free will, and citizenship in the context of war leads it to be grim, and that is not necessarily pleasant to read. But if you listen to me read the critique at the end of the previous episode, there are some readers who appreciate that kind of full consideration, even if it's not happy time. There are some readers who appreciate it. Okay, thanks again. We're done. I am not sure about the limitations of what is essentially an audiobook in podcast form, whether or not the hosts will assume its value decreases if I don't continue to post regularly. So I think I will post updates about my other works in the Moonifest Destiny podcast forum to keep this alive, unless I think of something else. I am presently going to start recording podcast for The Mysterious Matters of Max Metters, available on Kindle and as a paperback, published by Infinity Publishing. Passion, Philosophy, Fisticuffs, and Word Ferment. This is a boy meets girl story. Max discovers that Mary has a secret. He gives her every chance to tell it. Defiant, he even fights friends who try to warn him. Max vibrates with energy and feeling, an unrealistic way to live. This leads to troubled love affairs, complex friendships, tumbling thoughts, and mad conversations. In the 90s, readers passed around the do-it-yourself photocopied pages of this punk rock romantic novel. Now, new readers can discover its vigorous, maximalist voice that celebrates the sound and taste of words. My website is dangerquestmysteries.com. Email address, petergelman@yahoo.com. Thank you. Moonifest Destiny is available on Kindle for 99 cents.